Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life. Additional support for The Pulse is provided by AstraZeneca and Independence Blue Cross.
It's a disease of the rich, kind of thing, that you can afford to be depressed and not get out of bed.
Getting treatment for mental health issues despite so many misconceptions. I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
The galaxy we live in is on a crash course with Andromeda.
Beep, beep. Yes, you dream about it.
Giraffes don't faint.
No, they don't.
You just go about your life, and you don't notice a thing because it's just you.
Don't be so occupied with what you expect out of it, because that's bad science.
That's sometimes not so easy for somebody to let go.
Uh-oh. Uh-oh.
What happened?
Tomato sauce hit me in the face.
Click here, stop. Nothing to
interrupt this task.
No, I've got
you. Well,
just
going to have a new cane or cane. Stand in a position that's not right.
You know, MS is always going to be in your living room. It just shouldn't be in the center of your living room.
On today's show, some of the Nobel Prizes were just awarded, and they started in part to change the narrative of Alfred Nobel's life. So we decided to tell stories about changing narratives this week. Outrunning heart disease and obesity with the help of a few friends, refusing to call yourself a survivor, talking about gun safety without the politics, and understanding what bugs are saying to each other even when we can't hear them. But first up, in many African-American communities, mental health issues have a long history of being undertreated and underdiagnosed. Some psychologists blame the problem on a lack of access to care or limited insurance options, but there is something else at play. The stigma that is always attached to mental health issues seems even more fierce among African-Americans. Reporter Leela Day brings us this story of how beliefs rooted in the past can negatively affect people who need care now.
From a sunny living room in Berkeley, the sound of a violin pours onto the streets. The violinist is tall, in her late 20s, has a shaved head and a beanie cap propped to the side.
My name is Danielle Taylor.
Taylor is a violin instructor. She's warming up. She smiles a lot, and upon meeting her for the first time, my instinct is to give her a hug instead of a handshake. When she picks up her violin for an impromptu song, she goes into a deep calm. Everything feels serene right now. Taylor is in a calm place with her life and with her music, but it took her a while to get to this place.
I grew up in Sobrany Park in East Oakland. Definitely a poor working class neighborhood.
Sobrany Park is about 15 miles from where she lives now.
Growing up in Sobrany, particularly, you know, I think a lot of people have learned to navigate the world and be functional, carrying a lot of weight, basically, that I think would be useful to talk about.
This weight that Taylor's talking about is something she's felt since she was a young girl. She says her family was tight-knit, but her neighborhood was mostly lower income and high crime. A scholarship sent her from her mostly black public school to a mostly white one. She remembers feeling completely isolated and praying for things to change. Then, as she got older, she experienced a trauma that she doesn't like to talk about.
What I grew up understanding was that depression was something that white people experienced, you know, when they didn't have enough of whatever white people don't get enough of, you know, that. And whenever you had a problem, it's because you had a lack of faith. So praying and going to church could fix everything.
A 2011 report from the Centers for Disease Control found that even though African Americans are more likely to report major depression, only about 7% actually sought treatment. That's compared to 13.6% of the general population.
I think, in general, poor people haven't been allowed the luxury of mental illness. They don't have time. They don't have the money.
Dr. Loma Flowers is a clinical professor of psychology at the University of California in San Francisco. She believes that when looking at Black America's relationship to mental health care, we have to consider the cultural connection and history. The stigma that kept Danielle Taylor from sharing her depression with her family doesn't come out of nowhere.
it's a disease of the rich kind of thing, that you can afford to be depressed and not get out of bed. Whereas, you know, I think our history in this country, not getting out of bed was not an option.
Churches have long been the place where many African Americans find community and support. And some churches are recognizing that it's not just faith that people can lean on when having a mental health crisis. It's Sunday morning in Oakland, and about 30 people have gathered at the temporary home of the New Revelation Community Church.
Today, Jesus would be in the Black Lives Matter protest. Yeah. Jesus would be screaming, yeah, yeah, take the Confederate flag down.
Reverend Donna Allen's preaching is political, but it doesn't shy away from the personal, things like mental health. She tries hard to disassociate from the stigmas.
I think it helps, especially if I don't have stigmas and I don't have issues about someone having a mental health condition. And then the critical piece, supporting them, at least in the sense of following up with them, encouraging them.
Even with all the training in the world, a helper from the church wasn't going to be right for violinist Danielle Taylor.
I wanted, yes, someone skilled to say, to help me find different ways of looking at it, or is there a pattern? I want to know why. I can't get that in a prayer.
So she began looking for therapists. She reached out to the parents of her violin students to see if they could recommend therapists who took one-on-one clients and could meet her budget. She found someone who had a flexible payment plan. Today, Taylor says she's in a good place. She's found some balance between the trauma that plagued her for years and an outlet that gives her the space to work it out. But there are still some things that she holds back on. Taylor hasn't told her entire family that she's in therapy.
I don't feel the need to tell my older family members as well. I think they'd have maybe some criticism. I don't think it would be wholehearted support.
So, for now, when it comes to looking inward, Taylor confides in the person who she feels can help her most, her therapist. For The Pulse, I'm Leela Day.
Leela's story was originally produced for KALW in San Francisco with the help of the California Health Journalism Fellowship. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and our next story also relates to health issues in the African American community. It is less than a month until the New York City Marathon, one of the country's biggest, most popular 26.2-mile races. 50,000 runners will line up on the Verrazano Bridge in Staten Island, and depending on your perspective, these people are either the model of human discipline or a bunch of lemmings in spandex ready for self-abuse. Either way, what you won't see many of at marathons or most road races are African Americans. Minority groups make up just a small fraction of non-elite runners. The Pulse's Todd Bookman caught up with the members of a running club looking to change that.
Each Wednesday around 7 p.m., rain or shine, the members gather behind Philadelphia's Museum of Art.
Good, Mike.
Good to see you, man. Good to see you, man.
Good to see you. Congratulations, man.
Thank you, brother. Thank you, brother.
There's 15, maybe 20 runners today, dressed like runners, talking like runners.
How's the marathon training coming? You're tapering, right?
Everyone is wearing the club's T-shirt, the words Black Men Run printed across the front. But before you run, you should stretch a little. The guys break into a circle.
Cross your body. Cross your body. Basically, just loosening up your shoulders. We keep a lot of tensions in our shoulders when we run, so we want to just make sure we keep them as loose as possible.
Black Men Run got its start in Atlanta in 2013. The idea spread quickly, and there's now chapters in 50-something cities, and the club boasts 6,000 members. At the heart of the group are people like Michael Stinson. He's slogging his way through the first stretch of tonight's 5-mile route along the riverfront.
So how did you get into running?
I got into running, actually, maybe about 4 years ago, just out of desperation, something to lose weight. I was at 330 pounds and disgusted with myself. I started running on my treadmill, believe it's a true story, 5 minutes every day. And I saw the shape. I couldn't run for 5 minutes. So I had to run maybe 2 minutes and walk for three. But what it did, it got me in the habit every day of doing something. Then, you know, eventually 5 minutes turned into 10 minutes, then 15 and what have you. And eventually I was able to start running outdoors a couple months later, and the rest is history. I dropped 140 pounds. I feel great.
And is what you like about it, you think, influenced by the fact that you have this crew, that it's not just you out here? Because, you know, road running is you in your own head a lot of the time, but you got something different.
Totally. I ran for 2 years alone before I found these guys. And I found them literally out of frustration. True story. Came home from a run one day out here by myself. And I literally came home that day and I Googled the term, do black men run? And lo and behold, there's a group called Black Men Run. I didn't know they existed. And hey, there's a chapter in Philadelphia. And I found these guys, and a month later, bought my shirt and I was with them.
It's hard to know exactly how many black men do run, because road races typically don't ask demographic questions when you sign up. The best guess comes from a 2011 national survey that put the number of African-American runners at 1.6% of the sport's total participants, with whites making up 90%. So even while the elite distance races are dominated by Kenyans and Ethiopians, blacks definitely retain an outsider status in the middle and back of the pack.
My name is Gene Collier. I'm from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 47 years old. And being with Black Men Run, I have a community of brothers with me that holds me accountable, and I hold them accountable for keeping us safe, keeping us healthy, and I'm never alone. I like the fact that we are all we got. That's our motto. We all we got. We take care of each other. We look out for each other. But it's not a black and white thing, because we have white guys in the group. We have girls who want to join the group. Black Men Run is just a name, but internally, it's a movement to have a healthier lifestyle.
It's health, not race or racing, that's at the heart of the club's focus. African Americans have the highest rates of death caused by heart disease in the country, the highest obesity and diabetes numbers. Black Men Run, more than anything else, is an attempt to make a dent in those figures. This is Joe Collins near Love Park, coming up on 3 Miles.
This past Sunday, I ran the farthest I've ever run in my life. I ran 14 miles, and I'm 52 years old, all right? And it's crazy. I'm like, I've never run this far in my life. Even when I was 18, I have high blood pressure. By running and exercising, keeps my pressure down. I keep my weight down. Every time I see people, Joe, you lost so much weight. Oh, you look good. You look good. I said, thanks. Running. That's all I did, running. So this is working for me. I'm going to stick with it, baby. I'm going to stick with it.
Black Men Run isn't the only national club that targets a specific group. There's also Black Girls Run, White Girls Run, and Latinos in Motion. In fact, a lot of people in the sport see minorities as the next wave, the same way women swept into road running in the 70s and 80s. But a lot of these guys aren't actually new to the sport. They just weren't organized.
I've been running since middle school. My graphic arts teacher was the soccer coach. He seen I had a little speed, so he made me run track. He's also the track coach. Just been running from there. You know, I had my little inconsistencies. I got shot in 2010 in the chest. That was a struggle trying to get back. You know, I had a two-year-old at the time, and he helped me get back in shape.
What's the story behind getting shot?
Wrong place, wrong time. Wrong place, wrong time.
What do you think that when you show up to most runs, there's not a lot of African-American men at these road races? It's usually mostly white people, right?
You know, it's a stereotype. Black guys don't run. You know, we play ball, we run from the cops. But we actually do run without being chased by cops.
So what do you think it's going to take to get more people from your community running?
Just lead by example, man. You can't force anybody's hand. Only thing you can do is, you know, show them the benefits of it, man. I mean, good health, good attitude. I mean, who doesn't want to get involved in something as positive as Black Men Run?
All night, guys like Maurice El Bueno kept saying Black Men Run isn't about trying to exclude anyone or turn anyone away. The name, the shirts, it's all about outreach. It's trying to target a community that hasn't yet embraced the sport, that's perhaps felt isolated. Tonight's run ends at the Philadelphia Art Museum steps, the famous Rocky Steps. Benjamin Foots, a 61-year-old former smoker, sums up the mood.
I'm hurting in places where I don't even know I have. For real.
That's a reality runners of all colors, shapes, and sizes know too well. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman. This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. The Nobel Prize winners in the health and science fields were announced this week. Some of the honorees worked on therapies against infections caused by roundworm parasites or malaria. Also honored were new discoveries around neutrinos. And most of the Nobel Awards will come not only with a gold medal and a cash prize, but with a piece of original art illustrating the winner's achievement. The art will be tucked into a handmade leather folio opposite an elegant award certificate and received during the ceremony in December. That means for a handful of Scandinavian artists, it's crunch time. Carolyn Beeler reports.
Welcome to the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences. Welcome.
The commissioned artists find out who the winners are along with the rest of us at the public announcement ceremonies this week and next.
I will start by announcing the prize and read the citation.
By mid-November, the artists must create an original piece for each winner that represents the essence of their work. Swedish watercolor artist Hasse Carlsson will illustrate the economics diplomas this year and created last year's physics awards. Those went to three scientists who invented blue LEDs.
I remember that I was thinking that today's daylight can be restored and illuminate night, and the light of the LED lamp is awakening humanity. I was thinking about that when I did my paintings.
He made three black and white watercolors of people in dark overcoats, bathed in the light spilling from storefront windows and streetlights.
It was the white light I want to describe.
Carlson's work was unusually straightforward. Light, after all, is a subject well-suited to the visual arts. Suzanne Yardeback had a tougher time making a collage for the 2013 physics laureate Peter Higgs and the subatomic particle he discovered. Before she started, Yardeback asked a scientist to describe the Higgs boson.
She said it's not easy to describe it easily. It's very, very hard. You could try to do something with a Mexican hat.
Physicists use the model of an upside-down Mexican hat when describing the particle, an image Yardeback incorporated into her collage.
And in the background, I could use some sky that was, like, holy.
Holy, the Higgs boson's nickname of the God particle, inspired a color palette of midnight and aquamarine blues with highlights of celestial gold. Yardeback did Dr. Robert Lefkowitz's diploma as well. He won the 2012 Chemistry Nobel for discovering the largest family of cellular receptors for hormones in drugs.
The prize holds a pride of place in my office, and I think it immediately grabs the eye because of the artwork.
It's another collage, this time in pink and gold, with circles and tangled ribbons of color. Yardeback aimed for an abstract interpretation of the inside of the body, but Lefkowitz is not the hugest fan.
Well, let's just say it's different. I'm not an art collector, nor do I know much about art, but let's say I was, and I was going out to buy a piece of art. I suspect that's not the one I would have bought.
Lefkowitz does like the idea of original art being part of the prize, something he says adds to the once-in-a-lifetime Nobel experience. The award ceremony in December is steeped in tradition and formality, And there, like during the making of the diplomas, no detail is overlooked.
His Majesty the King, Carl Gustav, Queen Sylvia, Crown Princess Victoria, Princess Madeleine.
The Swedish royal family processes onto stage in full crown and sash regalia, followed by the Nobel laureates.
The aesthetics surrounding the Nobel Prize Award ceremonies have been important since the very start.
That's the Nobel Foundation's Annika Pontikis.
It's, you know, how the prize award ceremonies are arranged and the amount of time we put into making floral arrangements. The amount of work put into the diplomas is just one of all of these details.
Details creating a sumptuous red carpet experience for people more used to lab coats than white tie. Hasse Carlsson will create the art for this year's economics winner, or winners, who will be announced on Monday.
It will be stressful because I have only 7 days to create the final work.
That's when Carlsson says he needs to send a sample to an Austrian calligrapher so she can match her ink to his color palette.
So if they are going to be three, then it will be stressful. So I hope they will be one or two this time.
Probably the exact opposite of what every hopeful economist in the world is thinking right now. For The Pulse, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
You've probably heard the story of Alfred Nobel, inventor of dynamite, and how a French newspaper erroneously published his obituary in 1888 after Alfred's brother Ludwig had died. The paper declared that the merchant of death is dead and went on to say Dr. Alfred Nobel, who became rich by finding ways to kill more people faster than ever before, died yesterday. So Nobel saw this and he became concerned about the world he would leave behind and about how he would be remembered. So this is how the Nobel Prizes came about, rewarding those who are changing the world for the better. This seems timely as the country is once again embroiled in a fierce debate over gun violence after a shooting at an Oregon community college last week.
This is CNN Breaking News.
We are just getting word here of a school shooting. This is what we're getting from the Douglas County, Oregon Sheriff's Department. They are, quote, responding to reports of an active shooter at the campus of Umpqua Community College. This is in Roseburg, Oregon.
Micah, good evening. Law enforcement sources are calling this shooter an angry young man filled with hate. We're also hearing chilling accounts from students, including one 18-year-old student who says she saw her teacher shot in the head.
The United States of America is the one advanced nation on earth in which we do not have sufficient common sense gun safety laws, even in the face of repeated mass killings.
A gunman killed 9 people before killing himself after a shootout with police. New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof wrote an op-ed that got a lot of traction. He urged the country to take a public health approach toward gun safety.
Joining me now is New York Times columnist Nick Kristof, author of A Path Appears. Nick, thanks for joining us.
Sure. I mean, we have a
He
lot
wrote
of
that in America, more preschoolers are shot dead each year than police officers in the line of duty. He quoted the numbers for the year 2013, it was 82 preschoolers compared to 27 police officers.
Now, I hear all the time from people who say, well, what about cars? They kill people and we don't ban them. Well, of course we don't ban them, but we do regulate them to try to make them safer. And if you look at the auto mortality rate since 1921, we've reduced it more than 95%.
Kristof went on to argue for more smart gun technology that could make life with guns safer. Joining us now is one of the people working in that area. Omer Kiani is an engineer in Detroit and started the company Sentinel to develop gun safety technology. He was shot in the face as a teenager. This is not something he likes to talk about in much depth, but he does want to discuss the technology. Omer, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
You have experience with gun violence firsthand. What happened?
As a child, I did have experience with gun violence, but that's not what defines me. What defines me is I am a gun owner, I have children, and I am a safety engineer. It was always easy to wake up in the morning and go to work. because I knew that, you know, the work that I'm putting in is going to save a life when all other systems have failed. And that's what defines me. I'm a founder of a company that's developing the next generation smart lock.
Tell me how the technology works that you are developing.
So the first thing I'll say is most people, when they find out about it, they say, that didn't exist yet. But unfortunately, it doesn't. It's a simple clamp which disables access to a trigger by covering up the trigger guard area. When the authorized fingerprint are used to disable the clamp, you have instant access to the gun.
How long does it take for that fingerprint access to go through?
It's under a second.
Wow. So what is the promise of that technology and what are the limitations here?
So if you look at the gun violence in America, there's a lot of different aspects of it. But the biggest portion of gun violence is accidental discharges, and the second one is suicides. That's what we're looking to solve. That's the problem. That's the challenge that we're faced with. Firearm is a very simple and proven device. In essence, firearm was invented 400 years ago, and there's been very little innovation that's been brought into it. So what we're trying to do here is create a modern solution that will gel well. The reason Identalock gels with the existing proven technology, which is a firearm, is because it's an aftermarket accessory. It's not a retrofit. It's not integrated into a gun.
So there is a new foundation called Smart Tech Foundation. It was created by Silicon Valley investors after the Sandy Hook shootings. What has been the impact of that?
So as you know, innovation is hard, and it takes a lot to get something off the ground. What Smart Tech Foundation did is it provided initial funding to get projects related to gun safety off the ground. There were three different tiers, and my company, Sentinel, which is producing Identalock, was the winner of the highest grant. This grant allowed us to take a concept into a working prototype, which allowed us to further gain investors who allowed us to get to beta stage. And now we're tooling up to go to production. Smart Tech Foundation's grant and support was crucial in bringing this product to market.
Some surveys find that gun owners are not eager to buy this kind of technology because I guess there is a fear that maybe the gun will not work in a crucial situation. What's your take on that?
Yes. That is a valid criticism for technology that would be integrated inside a gun. Identalock has a key override, which allows the user to always disengage the lock regardless of what the electronics are going through. Secondly, we have, you know, 6 months of battery life, standby battery life, so we've done a lot to decrease any issues that could potentially come up with it.
And is your sense as a gun owner yourself that a lot of gun owners want their guns to be safer?
Yeah, absolutely. Because if a intruder breaks into a gun owner's house and uses their weapon, it is the gun owner's responsibility. So a lot of people are looking for a solution that they would be able to disable and secure their guns when they're not in use. There are existing technologies out there that in essence do similar things, but they lack the mobility or they lack the speed. So our technology combines the mobility, the speed, and the security.
Have you seen any other ideas, technologies that could address some of the other issues? For example, if a person who legally bought the gun, owns the gun, commits a terrible crime. Have you seen any ideas or technologies that address those issues?
Definitely. We need a lot of technologies that will each hit a portion of the problem with the eventual goal of eliminating the problem. With cars, you have brakes, you have active safety, you have stability control, you have airbags. You have so many different things trying to protect a human life. It will be no different. I foresee that it will be no different that in similar thing in the firearm industry.
But it seems that we're just at the very beginning of this journey.
Well, every, even a 1,000-foot journey starts with the first step. So I think this is an important critical step that we have to take.
Omar, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you so much.
Omar Kiani is an engineer in Detroit with the company Sentinel. He's working on developing a high-tech gun lock. This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. The world around us is turning pink, so it must be October, Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Over the next few weeks, thousands of people will take to the streets to raise money, to urge women to get mammograms, and to celebrate those who are ostensibly beating cancer, the survivors. For many, the word survivor spells hope and optimism. But some women who've had breast cancer are just not comfortable with the term. Perhaps that seems like a minor concern in the face of such a daunting illness, but words and labels are powerful, and sometimes finding a term that feels right can be an important part of defining oneself post-cancer. Long before there's even a thought about what you will call yourself once you get through a life-threatening illness, there's a moment that changes everything. For Jennifer Boyler, that moment came in 2011 when she found a lump in her breast. She was 34 years old and nursing her son at the time. Her doctor thought it was likely a blocked milk duct or a cyst, and she went to get it drained.
The surgical oncologist at that time went to do what's called an aspiration to pull the fluid out of what they thought was the cyst, and it wasn't a fluid-based cyst. And I would say that was the moment when I knew that I had cancer. So I watched his face, I watched his kind of visage change, and I thought, okay, something's happening. So he tagged the lump with a titanium marker and said to me that I would be going and having more imaging. So I got back in my car, and for context, my family were enjoying hot dogs from Sonic. And it was such a surreal moment. My life was changing.
Jennifer got through a double mastectomy, chemo, radiation, and breast reconstruction that she remembers as incredibly painful. It's hard to imagine any of this now. Jennifer looks perfectly healthy. She's energetic, with a bob of red hair and colorful earrings. Once she got better, she wondered how she would refer to her experience.
So survivor, when I looked up the definitions of it, survivor implies having lived through something that would have otherwise been deadly. And the synonyms for survivor are things like leftovers, bits and pieces, remnants.
She felt this didn't describe the pain, the fear and anxiety, the fact that for long stretches she couldn't pick up her two children. She says cancer nearly wrecked her otherwise strong marriage, so she chose another term.
I call myself cancer resilient. I actually have the word resilient tattooed on my thigh because I am. And it's not, survivor is also a very personal word. It's not just me that's cancer resilient. It's my whole family. We've all had to adapt.
I met Jennifer through two researchers at Rutgers University in Camden, New Jersey. They were conducting a study on women who've had double mastectomies. And in their interviews with participants, women talked about their feelings about the term survivor. So they decided to collect those thoughts.
When do I become a survivor? Is it when I had the surgery? Is it a 5-year out? So it's a very confusing term.
One woman said that when I die from something that wasn't cancer, then I could say I was a survivor.
These are the researchers for the study, Trish Suple and Bonnie Jerome D'Amelia. They both teach in the School of Nursing at Rutgers Camden. Here's Trish Suple again.
Some went into the fact that they didn't have it as bad as others. You know, one describing that, well, I didn't have to have chemo or radiation, therefore I don't consider myself a survivor because somebody else had it worse than I did.
Bonnie Jerome D'Amelia says women are constantly thinking about the threat of their cancer returning, and superstition comes into play.
So they felt that by owning the word survivor, they were maybe tricking themselves into believing that the cancer had gone away. And for all except for one of the women in our study, they truly believed they had not been cured.
They found that how women referred to their experience was a very individual choice and often became part of reclaiming their lives after cancer. If you don't like the term survivor, you do run into a bit of a naming problem. Survivor is short, it's snappy. Helen Cook, another woman who participated in the Rutgers study, doesn't love the term, but she also doesn't really like some of the alternatives, for example, warrior.
The flip side of that might imply that someone who doesn't make it didn't fight hard enough, didn't want it enough. I know for a fact that's not the case.
And when her brother called her a hero on Facebook, she felt flattered, but also thought it was too big of a word.
I did not run into a burning building to save a child. You know, I am simply dealing with my reality. And right now, my body is the burning building, so I don't have the option.
Instead, she likes to keep things simple.
I refer to myself as Helen. I am someone who has had breast cancer, and there's a litany of 79 other descriptors that would apply to me, so that's one of them.
Helen Cook is a consultant. She's an animal lover. She's a New Jersey resident, just to name a few other descriptions. Both Helen Cook and Jennifer Boyler say they believe awareness and fundraising is very important. They also don't mind other women using the term survivor to describe themselves. They just feel it's not right for them. But there's one thing that does drive Jennifer Boyler nuts. She was at a grocery store recently.
I saw a hat that had a little camo on it, and it said, "Save Iraq." And I took a picture, and the store manager was looking at me, and my husband's hiding his face. And I thought, I need to see that, because I need to do something about that. That's so far removed from what this is about. It's not about saving a woman's breasts. It's about women's lives. It's about their lives during, after. It's about their children's lives. The rack, the boobies, all of these save the boobies, that's not it. That's not it at all.
I feel a bond between us. I have felt like you do. I know better than to take it away from you.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and we're going to move on to something a little lighter right now, even though it also involves a deadly disease, but this one has been eradicated. Pulse reporter Tanya English was recently watching Last Comic Standing, and she saw a comedian on stage named Drew Thomas. He was bemoaning his lack of dating success, a highly original move for a comedian, but let's take a listen.
You could go to nightclubs and meet women, but I don't like going to nightclubs. Everybody in the nightclub is a liar. The men are lying. The women are lying. You got older women in the club trying to look young, but you know they older because they got that vaccine mark on their arm.
So given Tanya's inquisitive nature, she, of course, immediately started thinking about this cougar detector vaccine scar Drew Thomas was talking about. She had seen it on the upper arms of some people, but not on others. So she wondered, why is that?
If you're older than 40, you probably have a smallpox vaccine scar. It's often a dime-sized dent, usually on the upper left arm. Back when smallpox was one of the most frightening and disfiguring diseases around, most kids in the United States got the vaccine and the scar.
And just tap, 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 tap into that fluid. So it would push the virus into the skin.
That's Steve Gluckman. He's an infectious disease doctor with the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. He says getting the smallpox vaccine into the body takes some jabbing or scraping, but that's not really what causes the classic scar. The main ingredient in the vaccine is a live virus that creates a small local infection to jumpstart the immune system. The virus starts multiplying, and within days, the body tries to push out the infection.
Like it's red and pussy and drains a little bit, and then it heals.
The blister crusts over, the scab falls off, and what's left is a pockmark. Science writer Carrie Youngdahl says if you were a doctor practicing in the 1800s, the look of that scar could tell you a lot.
You know, you didn't have blood tests to determine whether a person had immunity. You couldn't do it titer and see if a person had antibodies.
Youngdahl directs a web project called The History of Vaccines.
The thought was, if you had a big scar, that meant you had a good take. And what that means is you had a robust local reaction to the vaccine.
For hundreds of years, smallpox outbreaks cropped up with each new generation. They called it the speckled monster. When smallpox arrived in a city, it often killed a quarter to 30% of infected people. Remember how we all worried about SARS and Ebola? Smallpox was worse. Quarantine separated families, trade stopped, and the economy was disrupted. Historian Jennifer Keelan says a vaccine scar was a way to prove that you weren't a risk.
So it's literally like wearing a vaccination record right on your arm. So the more prominent, the more clear, in some cases, they thought the more discrete scars there were, the better indication that you actually were protected from smallpox.
Keelan writes about smallpox epidemics and teaches at Concordia University of Edmonton in Alberta, Canada. To stop smallpox, the United States inspected immigrants at the border and passed compulsory vaccine laws for its own citizens.
Public health officials and local police would ask people to roll up their sleeves before they entered schools or before they entered factories or before they boarded trains or ships.
Michael Wilrich teaches at Brandeis University and wrote the book Pox, An American History.
In tenement districts in American cities, vaccination squads would go through during epidemics and check people for vaccination scars, and if they didn't have them, vaccinate them, often against their will.
But just like today, in the 1800s, there were vocal anti-vaccine lobbyists. When a city was on high alert, Wilrich says those opponents found ways to skip the vaccine and evade the police.
They put a little nitric acid at the spot where a vaccination would typically take place, on the upper arm. A similar scar would form that could be used to kind of fake out the public health officials.
In the United States, the last natural case of smallpox was in 1949. And over the next decade, outbreaks slowed down in developing countries as well. That's when the World Health Organization launched an ambitious global campaign to wipe out smallpox. Community health workers in Africa, South America, and Asia were trained to do mass vaccinations. They used a hypodermic injection gun that was considered high-tech back in the 60s. With that jet gun, workers could vaccinate as many as 1,000 people in an hour.
The foot pedal, when you pressed it down, it would deliver this burst of high-pressure air that would then travel through the gun and then shoot out through the vaccine canister and penetrate the skin.
Youngdahl doesn't want to press the trigger, but the pedojet kind of looks like that hypo spray gun that Dr. McCoy used on Star Trek.
Either Star Trek took inspiration from this, or maybe the manufacturers took inspiration from Star Trek.
The vaccine gun needed repairs all the time, and it turned out to be too intricate for field work. So after a few years, health workers switched to a simple needle.
25 needles. They're sterile until they're opened. It looks like a tiny two-tined fork. And what the vaccinator would do is use a new needle for every person, and he or she would dip the needle into the vial of vaccine, and a little tiny drop would balance itself between those tines.
The new method was cheap and low-tech, but patients had to endure a little bit more pain.
So they'd do about 15 sharp little jabs, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, up to 15.
Smallpox was eradicated around the world. And by the early 70s, the U.S. stopped giving the routine vaccine. The millennials missed out, but the generations before still have the battle scars. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Isn't this the sound of summer? Ah, don't get sad now. Insects calling from all over the place, every front lawn, bush, and tree branch. But most of what insects are saying to one another, we cannot hear. With the help of a local scientist, St. Louis Public Radio's Veronique LaCapra listened in on the hidden world of insect communication and one bug's unusual love songs.
That bug is called a tree hopper. They're actually pretty common, but easy to miss. The ones around here are small and black. When you see them clinging to a plant stem, they look a lot like tiny thorns. St. Louis University's Casey Fowler Finn studies the behavior of treehoppers, specifically how they go about finding mates.
So males fly from stem to stem or plant to plant, and when they land, they create advertisement signals. So that sounds like, ooh, boop, boop, boop. Then, if the female likes that male, she'll call back and she'll go, mmm.
How was that again?
Ooh, boop, 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 mmm.
That's actually pretty close. Here's a recording of two real Encinopa binatatas, the kind of tree hoppers Fowler Finn studies. You'll hear the male first, quickly answered by the female.
I love them. They're super cute, they're full of personality, and are just a lot of fun to listen to.
If you can hear them. The problem with tree hoppers, for scientists like Fowler Finn who study them, is that these little bugs don't make sounds the way we do. If a human male serenades a human female, we hear those sounds through the air. I know you want me, you know I want you. Some big insects, like cicadas, crickets, and katydids, also make airborne sounds. But to be heard through the air, you have to be loud, and that takes a lot of energy, too much for tiny insects like treehoppers. So they send their calls vibrating through a plant stem.
The plant stem actually physically moves, not enough that we can see it, but enough that they can pick it up with really sensitive sensors in their legs.
For insects, communicating through a substrate, like a plant stem or leaf litter, isn't as unusual as you might think.
It's actually quite common. About 90% of insects communicate through substrate-borne vibrations.
With tens of millions of insect species out there, that's a lot of chatter, almost none of which we can hear. At least, not without a little help. To listen in on tree hoppers in her lab, Fowler Finn uses a laser. The tree hoppers sit on a plant inside an incubator in front of the laser beam. Reflective tape on the plant bounces the laser light back into a sensor.
The laser then, it's measuring the velocity of the vibration of the plant stem, and the velocity directly translates into the pitch or the frequency of the signal.
A signal, or sound, that we can hear, like this male. Females of this particular kind of tree hopper usually go for males that call at a frequency of 385 hertz. But in the lab, Fowler Finn can play them calls at a lot of different frequencies. To the females, it sounds like they have lots of males to choose from. And the more choices they think they have, the pickier they get about answering back.
You don't want to be super picky if you only have crappy males around. But then if you know that you do have choice, it might benefit you to be pickier and to wait for that male that you really like.
It's hard not to relate all this back to people.
Yeah, it's good not to, but...
Fowler Finn is currently working with one of her graduate students to figure out how temperature affects treehopper calling behavior. They expect to have their first results by next spring. For The Pulse, I'm Veronique LaCapra. I'm picking up good vibrations.
She's giving me the excitations. Ah, there's another sound of summer, and that's how we're going to end our show this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Paige Flager, our associate producer, Joel Patterson, the managing editor, and Megan Pinto, our executive producer. Did you miss some of this show or any of our previous shows? Just subscribe to our podcast. It's on iTunes, and you can find it on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And I want to tell you about an upcoming event. We're going to have a special live interview with Bill Nye, the science guy, at the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia on November 9th. We'll talk about his latest book, which is about climate change, and you can find all of that information at whyy.org/events. And before we go, how about this for adaptability? Fire ants in South Carolina have been dealing with the terrible floods there by forming floating islands. They link their legs and mouths together to quickly weave a raft. And scientists who study this say the ants can stay afloat like this for weeks. And they found that the ant babies are especially buoyant. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Supporting WHYY is The Pulse. AstraZeneca strives to create a culture where employees are excited by their work, have a clear sense of purpose, and display confidence in their ability to meet challenges and seize opportunities. More at AstraZeneca.com/careers.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and strives to lead the way with a focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it. They are proud to offer health programs including fitness reimbursements and health coaches. IBX.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.